Hello, and welcome to the On SOA podcast series. In this special set of podcasts, SOA journalist Joe McKendrick interviews the authors and contributors behind the book, SOA Design Patterns, the newest title in the Prentice Hall Service-Oriented Computing series from Thomas Earle. You can learn more about this book and download sample chapters at soapatterns.com. Also, while listening to this podcast, you can look up any design patterns being discussed at soapatterns.org, a community site dedicated to the ongoing development and expansion of the SOA Patterns catalog. For more information about other series titles, be sure to visit soabooks.com. Now, here's Joe McKendrick.
Hello, this is Joe McKendrick, independent analyst and author of the ZDNet Service-Oriented Architecture blog site, as well as the eBizQ SOA in Action site. I'm here with Thomas Earle, author of SOA Design Patterns, a work just published by Prentice Hall. And Thomas is a prolific author. He's put together a number of books serving the SOA marketplace, probably one of the most prolific authors I know. And he also is the president and founder of SOAschool.com, which provides the internationally recognized SOA certified professional program. Welcome, Thomas.
Hi, Joe. Good to talk to you again.
And great to talk to you. This is number 6 of our 6-part series. If you haven't had a chance, please tune in to the first 5 parts, in which Thomas talked about how he started, the inspiration behind the book, the needs he saw in the marketplace, as well as the various classifications or types of patterns essential to SOA development these days. And with this, we're going to be talking about service design patterns and separation of concerns, an important theme in Thomas's book. Thomas, just to start off with, can you tell us what a separation of concerns is? What does that mean?
Yeah, it's certainly nothing new with SOA. It's a very established and accepted software engineering theory that basically is the fundamental basis of distributed computing in general. In a nutshell, it states that a larger problem is more easily and effectively solved if it is decomposed into a number of smaller, more manageable problems that we call concerns, for which you then can build corresponding units of solution logic, so solutions that solve the individual concerns. And from a theoretical perspective, that it goes beyond distributed computing into also forming the basis of composition. We solve these problems individually through different units of logic, but then we have the opportunity to, or the necessity usually, to assemble those individual solution logic units together in order to go back and solve that original larger problem. The big benefit here is that when we design those solution logic units properly in support of SOA by applying service orientation principles and practices, then we can design them in such a way so that many of them are capable of solving other larger problems and therefore forming the basis of composition as well as recomposition. So again, leading to continual and repeated reuse of what we build, so leading eventually to ROI and a number of other strategic benefits. So on a really foundational level, separation of concerns is something that is very important to designing services. It's also very much worth pointing out that service orientation is its own distinct design paradigm. It's comprised of a set of design principles and design concepts that are linked, have concrete links to the specific set of strategic design goals and benefits of service-oriented computing. If you're interested in learning about those goals and benefits, I would recommend visiting whatissoa.com. It lists them, and the principles themselves are discussed at soaprinciples.com. Those are the principles that comprise service orientation. Also, it is worth pointing out that service orientation has a specific means of applying the separation of concerns. Another very well-known, of course, paradigm, object orientation, has its own way of carrying out the separation of concerns. So we have two paradigms, one which, you know, service orientation, which has very many roots within object orientation, but does not carry forward all parts of object orientation. And if you're interested in a comparison of object-oriented and service-oriented design principles and concepts, SOA Mag published some articles along those lines a few months ago. Anyways, so the key thing when we think about what makes service orientation distinct on a fundamental level is the fact that it carries out the separation of concerns theory in its own distinct manner, specifically in how the concerns and the corresponding solution logic units are defined and ultimately designed and developed. And that leads to a set of patterns which are part of the book called Foundational Service Patterns. And these patterns, basically, they're five patterns that are documented in a recommended application sequence, in that one is suggested to follow the other in a certain order, and as such, they establish what we call a primitive process for service definition. They document separation of concerns within the context of service orientation in a very detailed way, because each step of the primitive process is its own design pattern and is documented in detail. So I find that level of documentation quite enlightening just from a learning perspective. If you're new to SOA and you want to understand what makes service orientation distinct, I find that this can be quite a valuable learning tool. Well, I'll just quickly go through the patterns themselves. The first one is functional decomposition. It addresses the decomposition of a larger problem into smaller problems and forming the basis of the logic that then has to be built in order to solve those problems. Service encapsulation is a pattern that requires us to identify what parts of the logic we have to build that are suitable for service encapsulation, that are suitable for encapsulation within services. And sometimes logic is not appropriately placed into a service. Of course, there is logic that may need to be manually carried out by a human, for which automation options are not available. But more of a gray area are tasks or actions that have to be performed that are very much entrenched within existing legacy environments, and there may be very hard constraints as to whether or not those legacy resources can successfully be encapsulated and exposed through a service. Sometimes they cannot, in which case other units of logic or other piece of logic may not end up in a service. And so the overall business process may be comprised of services being composed together with other types of actions being performed along the way. Agnostic context is a pattern that requires us to establish, to identify, and we apply this pattern iteratively as we carry out a service modeling phase initially. So we can apply it subsequently to its first application to refine services, service context. But it asks us to identify logic that is not unique or specific to a particular purpose or a business task or a business process. And as such, we use that logic to form the basis of an agnostic service, a service that has reuse potential. And as I mentioned in the previous podcast, the word agnostic comes from the Greek. It means without knowledge, and it's a term that is most suitable for what we're defining here. An agnostic service definition is a critical part of the overall definition process. But again, while we are conceptualizing the services, if we are applying these patterns during the service modeling stage without having moved toward the physical service design stage, then we have the opportunity to apply them iteratively and refine how we've defined services in previous iterations. So agnostic service context has to do with specifically that, looking for logic that has reuse potential, but also properly locating that logic in service context that are self-contained and distinct among themselves within a given service inventory. So partitioning services properly, applying other patterns like service normalization to ensure that all the boundaries are as aligned as they can be. Non-agnostic context is another pattern that deals with service definition, but here we look to isolate service logic that is single purpose, that does not have any identifiable reuse potential, and therefore is ideally abstracted into its own service layer. Through means of that abstraction, we can foster the agnostic logic in one layer and non-agnostic logic in the other. And when you have non-agnostic logic, logic that is specific to a particular task, a decision point you often have to deal with is whether or not that logic is suitable for service encapsulation, or whether you just want to place it into some non-service-oriented program that will end up being the initiator, the program with the bulk of the composition logic. And there are various considerations that go into that. I'll just mention that Herbjorn Wilhelmsson, who was a reviewer for the SOA Patterns book, just recently published an article called, I believe it's called The Case for the Single Purpose Service, where he talks about some of those considerations as to when it makes sense to apply non-agnostic context to a service as opposed to a non-service-oriented program. But either way, you're establishing a layer of abstraction when it comes to your solution logic, and that has to be identified as part of the modeling process, and of course, carries over into the design process. The next pattern is agnostic capability, which now has to do with organizing the functionality that you've defined so far as belonging to an agnostic service, so belonging within a given agnostic context, and then further partitioning that so that you can establish a set of agnostic capabilities. And when we use the term capability, we mean the part of the API that's invoked by the consumer. So if you're building your services as components, the capability would be the method. If you're building your services as SOAP-based web services, the capability would be the operation. So it's a implementation-neutral term that we use usually during modeling to basically say this is a function exposed by the service that can be invoked by a consumer. So agnostic capability is, again, a foundational pattern whereby we are looking specifically for agnostic services where we apply techniques to partition that logic into a set of individually consumable agnostic capabilities. So that's just a rundown of these patterns. But again, what's interesting to me when I study them, when I look at them, is how there are different SOA methodologies, different analysis approaches, different modeling approaches, different design approaches. But on a foundational layer, they all have these steps, or they should, because these are what lies at the core of applying service orientation to the separation of concern.
That's a great overview, Thomas. And one of the things you hear is, you shouldn't try to, as the phrase goes, you shouldn't try to boil the ocean when you're launching into or when you're designing a service-oriented architecture. It's good to tackle one component at a time or one problem at a time. Is this what is being addressed through this set of patterns?
It certainly can be. How you tackle the individual problems and the sequence in which you do it and the scope of how much you address, that is also very much influenced by the overarching methodology you apply. Is it a pure top-down approach? Will you have that upfront analysis phase as part of your project delivery? Or is it more bottom-up oriented, in which case you don't benefit from a lot of what we just discussed, but it's still an approach that is applied? And then there are different approaches that lie in between that try to draw compromises between addressing the strategic goals of top-down approaches versus the tactical short-term benefits of bottom-up approaches. So I think in terms of prioritization and scope of solving problems, with these patterns, based on the methodology you choose, you would essentially be extending this primitive process and perhaps even reorganizing the sequence of the patterns in order to accommodate those priorities. The manner in which they're documented in the book is just a recommended application sequence. As with any patterns, you have the opportunity to combine them into different combinations. That's what makes a pattern catalog often good enough or functional enough to be considered a pattern language, which is essentially looking at patterns as building blocks and allowing you to assemble them in all kinds of creative ways or sequences to solve not just one problem, but perhaps a set of related or dependent problems or a chain of problems, or having multiple patterns address one large problem. So there's endless possibilities. And again, the overall methodology and processes you apply to service delivery and SOA adoption in general will often dictate those sequences in relation to these foundational patterns.
Okay, great. That was great, Thomas. Again, we've been speaking with Thomas Earle, author of SOA Design Patterns, just published by Prentice Hall. And Thomas and his colleagues also maintain a community website, soapatterns.org, which we encourage everyone to check out for more information and more in-depth details on the patterns. And as I understand it, Thomas, this is a community process, so folks out there with ideas that they're working on can contact you? Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. We appreciate all and welcome all community participation. So what I'd like to encourage anyone interested to do is review the patterns. You can review and provide feedback about the established patterns, the master pattern catalog, but what is of primary importance to us is developing the candidate patterns so that we get a lot of comments and insights and opinions and validation. In terms of what's being published, they are going to undergo revisions in the future, and you can subscribe to the site if you want to be notified of how things change and of how content is added. And so we certainly want people to look at the site, provide feedback, and review the content, and of course use it. But also, there's an ongoing call for participation in that you are welcome to contribute your own patterns. You can contribute candidate patterns, which will automatically, once they're checked out by some people we have working on them, they get listed on the candidate patterns page and are then made available for review. You can also contribute a proven pattern. If you believe you have a pattern that truly has been validated and is proven and sufficiently mature to be part of the catalog, you can submit it on that level. It's a separate form. You're asked to provide some further project references that we have to check out and so on. But that is another option. So we are looking to grow and expand this catalog over time so that it becomes increasingly meaningful and important to the community.
Okay, great. We'd like to thank everyone for joining us. This was the sixth of six podcasts exploring SOA design patterns, and Thomas and I and other contributors will also be launching future podcasts with more details on the book. And we enjoyed having everyone with us today, and thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening to this installment of the On SOA podcast series. To learn more about the Prentice Hall Service-Oriented Computing series from Thomas Earle, please visit soabooks.com. Also, all the books in the series are available online at Safari Books Online, which can be accessed at safari.informit.com.